We are going to have a seminar together here, and it is my prayer, when we finish at 2 o'clock, you will be more able to answer the question, why do you believe the Bible is true, than when you came in to this seminar. If we can accomplish that in the next few minutes, it'll make everything worthwhile. I was at Arizona State University. I had just finished speaking at a large outdoor rally. I walked down off the platform, and a professor came to me with 10 students from a graduate seminar. He said, "You know, you're really funny, Mr. McDowell." I said, "In what way?" I didn't know I had a lot of humor. He said, "Everything that you've been teaching on campus for 3 days comes from a book written years after the time of Jesus Christ, way into the second century. What people didn't like, they took out. What they did like, they added to the book. And then he turned to the students. He said, "I just finished teaching this to my graduate seminar. How would you answer that gentleman?" I said to him, "Sir, in love," I said, "your mentality is 25 years out of date." I said, "That's what people believed 25, 40 years ago, but not anymore because of the evidence." Now, I'd like you to do this exercise right now where you're sitting. I want to take about 4 minutes, and I would like each one of you to write down on a sheet of paper that I'm going to have you give to me at the end of the session. Write down on the sheet of paper 3 questions you're always asked about the Bible and its reliability. What are 3 questions? When you start to talk to someone, they'll often ask you about the Bible, whether it's believable, credible, accurate, or what. Will you write those 3 questions down very clearly? We'll take 4 minutes to do that. 3 questions that you're asked about the credibility of the Bible. Be very specific. 3 questions you're asked about the credibility of the Bible. 3 questions on the credibility of the Bible that you are asked in your country. You should have those written down. On the overhead that I have here, just something I wanted to share with you. As of right now, the Bible has been translated into 1,667 languages or dialects. Another 890 languages and dialects are being translated right now. Every 7 days, they begin translating the Bible in a new language. Every 7 days, somewhere in the world. Every 9 days this year, the entire New Testament will come off the printing press in a new language. Every 9 days. Every day, over 3,000 translators are working on the Bible. That's more than any other book in history. Now, before we go into the presentation of this seminar, I'm going to ask the workshop steward, Mr. Little, to come and open us in prayer.
May we bow our heads. Our great Heavenly Father, we thank you for the opportunity to come together and learn from such men as Josh McDowell, methods that he uses and will have us to study and use in our own work, in our own homes, in our own lands. And we ask that that divine blessing be upon each and every one represented here today. We ask that they may, in love, go back to their communities better armed to handle your work. We ask that divine blessing upon each one of us here, in Jesus' holy name. I'm sure most of you know the gentleman who has been speaking to you and who will be speaking to you, Reverend Josh McDowell. Josh is a traveling lecturer for Campus Crusade International. He's one of today's most popular speakers on university campuses. During the last 20 years, he has spoken on more than 650 university campuses in 74 countries to more than 7 million students. He is the author of 26 best-selling books and has been featured in 19 films. A graduate of Kellogg College, Wheaton College, and Talbot Theological Seminary, he's recipient of many academic and civic awards and holds honorary doctorates in law and theology. He and his wife Dottie have three children. They reside in Julian, California, in the USA. And his favorite Bible verse is Romans 1:16. That's it?
When he mentioned my wife, it makes me homesick, like I'm sure some of you are. Not because of my wife, but yours. I am married to one of the most wonderful women on the face of the earth. It's almost like it's a dream, and someday I'm going to wake up, and I'm not married to Dottie. We have four children, 12 years old, 10 years old, 6 years old, and 9 weeks. And the reason my wife is not here with me is that we could not get a passport for our baby because she is adopted and it takes 9 months in the United States to get a passport. And she wouldn't fit into my attaché bag. Now, in the next few minutes, I want to put an outline that you can take with you the rest of your life to talk with people about the reliability of the Scriptures. I'm going to try to make it as practical as I can. This is the outline that I use when somebody says to me, "You don't believe the Bible, do you? Why, it was written 2,000 years ago. You can't trust it." Well, I think I can. The background of what I share here, as a student in the university, I set out to write my first book, Evidence, against Christianity. I set out to write a book to make a joke of the Christian professors on campus. I figured any fool could do that, and I'd qualify. I figured most Christians had two brains. One was lost, and the other was out looking for it. I figured an intelligent approach to the evidence would totally refute the reliability of the Bible. After 2 years of research, I had a problem. Intellectually, I came to believe that I could trust the Bible. And then I spent 13 years writing my first book, Evidence, Why. I want to share with you here the basic outline of what I discovered. Whenever you approach any document in history, say like the Bible, you apply what is called an historiography. An historiography, that is, it's made up of principles to check out the accuracy of a document. There's three steps of a good historiography or of a good approach to examining a document in history. The first step is called the bibliographical test. The bibliographical test. The bibliographical test asks questions about the manuscripts of a document. Now, what is a manuscript? A manuscript, by definition, is a handwritten document over against a printed document. The first question it asks about the manuscripts is, what is the timeline? You say, what do you mean, timeline? From the original copy, referred to technically as the autographa, or autograph, from the original copy to the closest manuscript, how much time is there? Here is a line. Number one is the original copy. It deteriorates. From the original copy, they copy from it what is called generation number two manuscript. Then that manuscript starts to deteriorate. They copy generation number three. That manuscript begins to deteriorate. They copy number four, number five, etc. The question is, from the original to the closest manuscript, how much time is there? The closer the copy to the original, usually the greater the accuracy. I've learned one thing over the years. The more I compare the Bible with other literature, the greater respect and appreciation of the Bible I have. Let's do that. When we look at secular literature, from its original to the closest manuscript, what is the timeline? Pliny the Younger, the historian, from the time he wrote to the closest manuscript is 750 years. Caesar, writing the Gallic Wars, from the time he wrote to the closest manuscript is 1,000 years. Plato, 1200. Aristotle wrote his Poetics, 343 B.C. The closest manuscript is 1100 A.D., 1400 years later. Sophocles, 1400. Euripides, 1500 years. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come to the New Testament, we go back within 80 years with the New Testament. Illustration. The John Ryland papyrus, called papyrus because it is written on the papyri reed, 125 A.D. That's a very tiny portion. Papyrus Bodmer II manuscript, 155 A.D. The Chester Beatty papyrus, the 3rd century. Sinaiticus and these other manuscripts, 4th and 5th century. Time-wise, from the original to the closest copy, there is more evidence for the New Testament than any 10 pieces of classical literature put together. You say, how do you date a manuscript? There's a number of ways we do it. One is the type of material that it is written on. You can often date the manuscript. Second, the size and the forms of the letters. Down through history, they wrote differently. And by the type of writing, you can tell when it was copied or written. The punctuation and the division of the text changed down through history. Then ornamentation. Some of you have seen some very old books, and at the beginning of the chapter, they'll have a fancy ornamentation. They used to do that with manuscripts, and that ornamentation would help to date the manuscript. Another way, the color of the ink will date a manuscript. And then the texture and the color of the material that it was copied on. These are the main ways to date a manuscript. But time-wise, there is more evidence for the New Testament than any 10 pieces of classical literature combined. Dr. William Foxwell Albright, one of the great archaeologists of all time, a man respected by both liberals and conservatives. He was not a Christian. He was not a believer. In his lifetime, he wrote more than 800 books and major articles. Most of us won't read that many in our lifetime. He wrote them. He made this statement. We can already say emphatically that there's no longer any solid basis for dating any book of the New Testament after about A.D. 80. Two full generations before the date between 130 and 150 given by the more moral, radical New Testament critics of today. The second question of the bibliographical test. First is the timeline. Second is the number of manuscripts. The more manuscripts you have, the easier it is to reconstruct the original and check out any errors or discrepancies. Let us look at secular literature first of all. Caesar and the Gallic Wars. Of Caesar and the Gallic Wars, only 10 manuscripts survive. Everything else has been lost in history. Of Plato, only 7 manuscripts survive of Plato. Tacitus, the 2nd century Roman historian, of his annals on history, less than 20 manuscripts have survived. All the rest have been lost in history. Thucydides, the Greek historian, 8. Herodotus, 8. Aristotle and his Poetics, 49 manuscripts survive. Aristophanes, 10. Now it's up to 12. They just found 2 more. Ladies and gentlemen, of the New Testament alone, we now have 24,633 manuscripts of just the New Testament. 24,633 of the New Testament. There is no close second. When I came out with Evidence That Demands a Verdict in 1974, I was able to document 14,000 manuscripts. Now, because of new discoveries made, can document 24,633. Let's see how unique that is. Is there anyone here who knows the number 2 book in all of history in manuscript authority? The New Testament is number 1. Anyone here that knows the number 2 book in manuscript authority in all history? Anyone? What? Stand up. Homer, the Iliad. Where did you learn that? Excellent. The Iliad by Homer. Let's see how sharp he is. Very good. 643 manuscripts. Here is the comparison. On the chart, the number 2 in all history is the Iliad with 643 surviving manuscripts. Of the New Testament, 24,633. I will guarantee you, you will never find that documented in a textbook in a university, unless it's one of my books. I never knew this until I set out to make a joke of the New Testament and found out the joke was on me. Number wise, there's 20 times more evidence, manuscript authority for the New Testament, than any of the 10 classical works put together. You can take every manuscript in the world and burn it. Take every Bible in the world and destroy it. And within 150 to 300 years of Jesus Christ, I can reconstruct all but 11 verses of the entire New Testament. You say, now wait a minute. Without any manuscripts, without any Bibles? Yes. This way. The early church fathers, when they would write out their talks, like Robbie Zacharias this morning talked about, he'd written out his manuscript. When the early church fathers would write out their manuscripts, they would write out scripture in their manuscripts. When I first came out with evidence in 1974, I could document 36,000 quotations of the New Testament in the early church fathers. Now, because of further research and some discoveries made in the British Museum, I can now document 86,489 quotations of the New Testament by the early church fathers. Taking their works, can reconstruct all but 11 verses of the entire New Testament. As far as I know, that's the only book you can do that with. F.F. Bruce, the New Testament scholar, Manchester University, England, says, quote, "The evidence for the New Testament writings is ever so much greater than the evidence for many writings of classical authors. The authenticity of the classical authors, of which no one would dream of questioning them. And if the New Testament were a collection of secular writings," he is saying that if the New Testament was a secular writing, "its authenticity would be regarded as beyond all doubt." If it were a secular writing. The first test, the bibliographical test. Ask about the timeline and the number of manuscripts. The second test that you apply to any document is the internal evidence test. The internal evidence test. This test has three applications, and the internal evidence test. The first factor in applying the internal evidence test to any document is this. In the event of an apparent discrepancy, an apparent inaccuracy, the benefit of the doubt is given to the author, not to the critic. If there comes to be in a document what appears to be a discrepancy, the document is considered to be accurate, first of all, unless by proven documented evidence it is shown to be inaccurate. In other words, a document is innocent until factually proven to be guilty. When you look at an apparent inaccuracy in the scripture, and this is one of my favorite areas, you need to take into consideration several things. One, the grammar. Do we properly understand the grammar in what appears to be a discrepancy in the document? Illustration. In Acts chapter 9 and Acts 22, there are two different accounts of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus, the Apostle Paul. For years, the liberal scholars criticized the scriptures because of what they said was a proven inaccuracy in this sense. In chapter 9, it says when Paul was on the road to Damascus, that those with him were hearing the voices of the one spoke. It says they heard the voices, but they didn't see anyone. In Acts 22, it says they saw the light, but they did not hear the voices. And they said, look at there. In the same book of the Bible, you have a discrepancy. In Acts 9, it says they heard the voices. In Acts 22, it says they didn't hear the voices. No one knew how to answer that for years. Until, through various archaeological discoveries of manuscripts, they found out there was different uses of the verb and the grammatical structure. And this is what time revealed. In Acts 9, it expresses nothing about understanding what you hear. In Acts 9, it says that all you did was hear something. It doesn't mean you understood it. In Acts 22, they discovered it means to understand what you hear. And all of a sudden, it was cleared up. When in Acts 9, it says that they heard the voice, it doesn't mean they understood what they heard. It's just that sounds reached their ears. In Acts 22, when it says they didn't hear the voice, the meaning is they didn't understand what was heard. And all of a sudden, what for years they said was a discrepancy was cleared up. We have to make sure we understand the grammatical use. And then, the historical progression of a passage. Illustration. Matthew and Mark say that the thieves hanging on the cross with Jesus both cursed him. Matthew and Mark says the thieves cursed Jesus. But Luke says that only one thief cursed him, the other believed in him. And the critics have come to me in the university and say, see, a proven discrepancy. I'll say, wait a minute. Did you ever see the progression here? And this happens all the time. It starts out with both thieves cursing Jesus. But as they saw the way Jesus responded, they saw his character comes out. One of the thieves turned from cursing to believing and said, remember me this day when you come into heaven. I see this all the time in the university, where two professors will come up and challenge me, and they'll both be adamantly against the gospel. But by the end of an hour of conversation, one of them says, can we get together and talk? I'd like to learn more. Well, initially, they both were cursing the gospel, but then you would say, one of them came to desire to know more, and the other cursed it. Then you need to make sure you have a proper understanding of the numbers that are used in an apparent discrepancy. Illustration. In Genesis 15 and Exodus 12, it says that the Israelites were in Egypt for 400 years. Later Exodus says they were there for 430 years. And Stephen's in the book of Acts says the period was 430 years. One account says 400. The other account says 430 years. And for years the scholars have said, look, an absolute contradiction in the Bible. But read the text carefully and make sure we have an understanding of the numbers used. For example, Genesis 15 says that the Jews were enslaved and mistreated for 400 years in Egypt. They were enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. Exodus 12 says the length of the time of the Israelite people in Egypt was 430 years. Here's the explanation of it. Under Joseph, for 30 years, they weren't enslaved. They were in peace. And all of a sudden, what people have said for years is a contradiction. By understanding the numbers, it was cleared up. They were in Egypt for 430 years, of which 400 of those years, they were enslaved. And all of a sudden, there's no contradiction. Another one in 2 Kings 15. There's a mention of the king Tiglath-Pileser, and said that he conquered the Israelites of the northern kingdom. Very clearly. Do you know, for years the scholars mocked at this? For this reason. Apart from this reference in the Bible, absolutely no trace of this man. In all archaeological discoveries, literature, everything, no trace. So they said, look, it's in error. This man never lived. But then the archaeologists discovered Tiglath-Pileser's capital city of his kingdom. In there, on bricks, they found inscribed on bricks this: I, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, am a conqueror of the regions from the great sea, which is in the country of Amuru, as far as the great sea, which is in the Nairi country, the Mediterranean. Later in other descriptions, it describes his conquering of the Israelites of the northern kingdom. And all of a sudden, the scholars had to say, wait a minute, it was historical. So when you come to grapple, to struggle with an alleged contradiction, not only do you need to make sure you understand the grammar, the numbers, but third, before you can call it a discrepancy, you have to make sure that no further research could ever shed light upon the problem. For example, Jesus said that Moses wrote the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. The Old Testament said he wrote it. The New Testament said he wrote it. The Jewish historians said he wrote it. The prophets said he wrote it. The scholars said he did not write it for this reason. They said at the time of Moses, there was no alphabet. And if there was no alphabet, how could Moses write the first five books of the Bible? Now that's been silenced because of further research. Now we can document six languages, six alphabets going back before Moses. And so in the internal evidence test, the document is considered innocent until a proven discrepancy factually is pointed out. The next factor of the internal evidence test is the nearness of the witness to the document, the greater the accuracy. You say, what do you mean? The nearness of the witness to the event the document is talking about, the greater the accuracy. In other words, eyewitness accounts are your primary witnesses. If you have an eyewitness of an event, it is considered to be much more accurate than somebody who was not there and recording someone else. When we look at the New Testament, we need to realize that they wrote as eyewitnesses, or they recorded eyewitness accounts. They wrote as eyewitnesses or recorded eyewitness accounts. Illustration, the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 3. To these he also presented himself alive after his sufferings by many convincing proofs, appearing to them over a period of 40 days. Said for 40 days they lived with him, they walked with him, they ate with him as eyewitnesses. 2 Peter 1:16. 2 Peter 1:16. For we did, now here were the Jews confronting Peter. And Peter says to the Jewish leaders, for we did not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known to you the power and coming of the Lord Jesus. But we were eyewitnesses. We were eyewitnesses. John 20, verses 30 to 31. In John 20, 30 to 31, John says, many other signs. Now, why did Jesus do signs? to convince people he was the Messiah. It says many other signs, many other things Jesus did to convince people he was the Messiah, which have not been recorded. What is John saying? He said many other things Jesus did, quote, in the presence of his disciples to prove that he was the Messiah that have not even been recorded. They were eyewitnesses. Luke chapter 1 says that he examined everything carefully that had been taught among them from those who were eyewitnesses. Most people do not realize that. They wrote as eyewitnesses or recorded eyewitness accounts. But then a lot of people don't realize this. They not only wrote as eyewitnesses or recorded eyewitness accounts, but in the presence of the most hostile witnesses, they appealed to their knowledge of the evidence. You say, what do you mean? They not only said, look, we saw these things, but to their audience they would say, you did too. Now I know one thing. When I go into a debate, and when I go into a debate, I study my opponent's position as much as I study my own. And in a debate, I keep challenging my opponent on the evidence that I am presenting. And if I dare to depart from the truth, believe me, they'll shove it right back down my throat. And yet with the New Testament, the material was presented in the presence of people who knew about Jesus, what he did and what he said. And if they would have dared to have departed from the truth, it would have been corrected immediately. Illustration. Acts chapter 2, verse 22. Here was Peter being challenged by the Jewish audience about Jesus. He says, men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested, not just to us, but to you, by miracles and wonders and signs which you yourselves know. What did he do? Peter said, look, we not only saw these things, but you did too. Well, I can tell you one thing. If they had not seen those miracles and wonders and signs, there wouldn't have been one of them converted, let alone thousands. In chapter 26 of Acts, Paul was brought before the king. He presents his evidence. The king challenges him on the evidence. And Paul says, I speak to you with confidence because I am confident that none of these things have escaped your notice. For this was not done in a corner. What did Paul do? Paul took his whole argument for Christianity and threw it out onto the lap of the king and said, you know what I'm talking about. That is one of the greatest tests for any document in history to see if it's accurate. Was it presented in the presence of hostile people who knew the facts that if the writer or the speaker dared to depart from the facts, it would be corrected? And the New Testament was. It's one of the greatest applications to check out a document in history. Next, the external evidence test. The first is a bibliographical test. Ask questions about the manuscripts. How far is the copy from the original? Then, how many manuscripts do you have? The more manuscripts you have, the easier it is to recreate the original and check out any errors or discrepancies. The internal evidence test, the second test, says, first of all, a document is innocent until proven guilty. Then it says, the closer the witness to the event, the greater the accuracy. In other words, we're the eyewitnesses. Now the third test, the external evidence test. The external evidence test
ask this question. Is there material, apart from the document you're studying, that confirms the inner testimony? Say, what do you mean? Take the New Testament. Is there material, going back to the first and second century, apart from the New Testament, that confirms the inner testimony of the New Testament? That's why it's called external evidence to confirm the document you're studying. Two types of testimony or evidence is used here. One, literary. Two, archaeological. The first, literary evidence. Time permits me to only touch in two areas. Irenaeus lived 180 A.D. Irenaeus was the bishop of Lyons. He was a disciple of Polycarp. Polycarp died 156 A.D. Polycarp had been a Christian for 80 years. Polycarp studied under the Apostle John in the first century. Wouldn't that be great? Who's your cell leader, John? Now, notice the progression here. Going back to the first century, the Apostle John taught Polycarp. Polycarp taught Irenaeus. Now, Irenaeus records for us in 180 A.D. what his teacher had taught him that he had gotten from the Apostle John in the first century. This takes it all the way back to the first century. This is what he said. So firm is the ground upon which these Gospels rest, that is, the four Gospels, that the very heretics themselves bear witness to them. And starting from these, that is, starting from the four Gospels, each one of them endeavors to establish his own particular doctrine. Now, what is he saying here, going all the way back to the first century that John said this? It is saying this, that even back in the first century, the foundation of the four Gospels was so solid, all the way back to the first century. Then we go to a man by the name of Eusebius. Eusebius records the writings in 339 of Papias. Papias was the bishop of Hierapolis. Papias also got his teachings from the Apostle John in the first century. So here's the timeline. You have John in the first century. What John said is recorded by Papias. What Papias said is related to us by the historian Eusebius. Now, what does Eusebius say? Quote, the elder used to say, now the elder here, the Apostle John, the elder used to say this also, Mark, having been the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately all that he, Peter, mentioned, whether sayings or doings of Christ. For the interpreter, I'm going to jump down in the quote. So then, Mark made no mistake. Now this goes back to the first century. Mark made no mistake, writing down in this way some things as Peter mentioned them. For he paid attention to this one thing, not to admit anything he had heard, and not to include any false statement among it. End quote. Takes it all the way from Eusebius back to the first century, external evidence of a testimony of the internal message of the New Testament. The first evidence is literary. The second is archaeological. Archaeologically, is there evidence that goes back to the first couple centuries that confirms the accuracy of the New Testament. A man by the name of Sir William Ramsay was one of the world's great archaeologists, or more known as a geographer. He left England to go to Asia Minor to do a study, a geographical study of the first century. He spent 30 years in Asia Minor doing it. You talk about patience. 30 years the scholar spent there doing a study of the geography of the first century. He was not a Christian. He believed the New Testament was a second century document written years after the time of Christ and therefore could not be accurate about things of the first century. After a number of years in Asia Minor, he totally exhausted first century documents and he didn't know where to turn to. Somebody suggested the New Testament. He laughed at him. But after a while, he said, "What do I have to lose?" So he studied the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. Years later, this great scholar made this statement. Luke is an historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians. Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect of its trustworthiness. How could he say that? Let me just give you two pieces of evidence that he found. His arguments to this day have never been answered. In Acts chapter 18, verse 12, Luke uses the word proconsul, P-R-O-C-O-N-S-U-L, proconsul, for the title for Gallio, G-A-L-L-I-O. All the scholars said, that is wrong. Ramsay said, well, since he was probably writing the second century, Gallio lived in the first century, it's wrong. Because all the works on Gallio never gave him the title of proconsul of Acacia. And his life had been outlined in detail. So the scholar said it is wrong. But then they discovered the Delphi, D-E-L-P-H-I, the Delphi inscriptions. And it says this, quote, "As Lucius Junius Gallio, my friend and the proconsul of Acacia." And all of a sudden, Ramsay had to say, wait a minute. How could an author writing in the second century know such a detail about someone in the first century? He said it doesn't make sense. Then in Acts 17, verse 6, Luke uses the word Polytarch, P-O-L-I-T-A-R-C-H, for a title given to the civil authorities of Thessalonica. What? All the scholars said that is wrong. Why? No reference in history to any title but Polytarch for the civil authorities in Thessalonica. In fact, that word is not even found in classical Greek. So all the scholars said Luke is wrong. And Ramsay said, well, of course, someone writing in the second century would expect to make a mistake like that. But then they found 19 inscriptions, secular inscriptions, using the word Polytarch. And here's the humorous part of it. Five of them were direct references to civil authorities in Thessalonica. All of a sudden, Ramsay said, wait a minute. How could a second century author be so accurate in detail about the first century when everybody else was wrong? Ramsay concluded, the New Testament had to be a first century document. And he said the book of Acts and the Gospel of Luke had to be written around 50 A.D. This is why many scholars, like the Roman historian Dr. A.N. Sherwin White, says, for the New Testament book of Acts, the confirmation of historicity is overwhelming. Any attempt to reject its basic historicity, even in matters of details, must now appear absurd. Roman historians have long taken it for granted. F.F. Bruce, again of Manchester, England, says, where Luke has been suspected of inaccuracy, accuracy has been vindicated by some inscriptural archaeological evidence. It may be legitimate to say archaeology has confirmed the New Testament. Ladies and gentlemen, three tests apply to any document. The bibliographical test, asking about the timeline and the number of manuscripts. Second, the internal evidence test, innocent until proven guilty. And the closer to the witness is to the event, the greater the accuracy. And then the third test, the external evidence test, with two lines of evidence, literary evidence and archaeological evidence, as I set out as a non-Christian to apply them to the New Testament, I had to conclude, if I cannot trust the New Testament, then I am going to have to throw out all literature of antiquity and become an historical agnostic and say I cannot trust or believe anyone. And finally, it drove me to Jesus Christ. I was convinced the Bible was accurate. Once I was convinced it was accurate, then I considered its message, and God the Holy Spirit convicted me, and I placed my trust in Christ. And now, I know the Bible is true because it's changed my life. Now, we have covered a lot of material here. Now, before my closing comments, I want to do this. I want each one of you, or if you came with someone else, the two of you together, to do this. I want you to take 10 minutes, and I want you to take what I have talked about here and apply it to one of those three questions that you wrote down that people ask you about the credibility of the Bible. I want you to do that right now, and then I'm going to take 5 minutes and close our seminar off at 2:05. Each one of you individually or two of you together, talk to each other and write out an outline of what I've shared here that would answer one of the questions you wrote down. I'm going to ask each one of you to do that, because if you don't do that here, you won't do it later. So let's take 9 minutes now and do that.